We'll open the House Committee on Revenue. Today is the 26th of May. It's we're getting started about 5 minutes late, and I apologize for being late. We do have a quorum sufficient to go ahead and start our meeting today. We are scheduled for both a work session on Senate Bill 480, which is a work in progress, and a public hearing on House Bill 2758. What I'd like to do is, because both of these bills deal with directing the Department of Revenue to work around and establish, promote the voluntary compliance initiative and a general tax amnesty, what we'd like to do is go ahead and open the public hearing on 2758 as well as the work session on 480 so that we can gather that testimony both together at the same time. So with that, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 480 and I'm opening also a public hearing on House Bill 2758. We have a couple of folks signed up on 2758. Let's see. Richard York has signed up. And let's see. I thought I had the pronunciation here. I'll just go.
Is that where she weeps or wiggles?
Dibing, Mr. Dibing. When we get you both up here again, you both testified on the last one. But
there you go.
One on that floor.
And then we would like to hear from someone. If the banking community is going to be represented today, okay. Because we'll be working both a work session on Senate Bill 480, I would like to have the banking community, if they could, prepare and the business community respond to some of the components within the proposal. Gentlemen, please. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard York. I'm retired and I live in Portland. I'm here to testify against House Bill 2758. An article in the June 2004 Tax Advisor demonstrates that a combination of carrots and sticks is the most effective way of promoting a tax amnesty. Most states offer reduction or elimination in penalties, but do not eliminate interest. Most states follow their amnesties with significant increases in penalties to motivate the amnesty. Many states, as sticks, also require participating taxpayers to waive all rights to refunds and or judicial or administrative reviews. Colorado in 2003 was a classic example of this. As far as I can tell, HB 2758 offers such a huge carrot that it would keep Bugs Bunny out of Elmer Fudd's garden for a year. And we've taken away poor Elmer's trusty shotgun. As one who pays his taxes every year because I'm withheld, I find it difficult to see those who don't pay their taxes getting away scot-free. And I know they are keeping interest in 2758, but some penalties and some increased penalties, I think, are called for. While some of these people have problems which cause them to miss paying some taxes, it truly seems unfair to me to have no penalty at all due from people who have essentially scoffed at the tax laws in this state. And that's the end of my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. York. Mr. Dybig?
My name is Del Dybig. I'm testifying on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, as well as myself. We're a citizens group. We are not compensated by anybody. With respect to the amnesty in general, and that is, I believe, one should differentiate between an amnesty for people who fail to abide by their income tax obligations, because either they're uninformed, uneducated, or just basically not financially sophisticated. And on the other side of the coin, we have people or organizations, corporations, wealthy individuals who are involved in tax shelters. I believe these are basically two different classes or two different types of taxpayers which need a different approach. The tax amnesty proposal in 2758 offers a brief opportunity for non-filers and underreporters of income tax to pay their tax liabilities without paying penalties for their past tax violations. The language of this bill would also allow participants in abusive tax shelters who may have already been apprehended or identified by the IRS to escape state penalties for past tax violations. Now, general amnesties have been used by many states, I believe more than 40 from what I've read. They are generally a cheap substitute for tax law enforcement. Sometimes they raise revenues, but overall, the general amnesties with provisions such as those there in 2758 have not had much of a long-term impact on state revenues. Serial amnesties, and I don't believe Oregon has yet had them, may actually be like the continuous department store sales encouraging taxpayers to become non-filers, except during amnesties. However, a well-designed amnesty should help the tax system. If the forgiveness of penalties linked to enforced and enforceable new post-amnesty penalties and an extended statute of limitations, that may encourage current violators to pay up and to encourage future responsibility. Recently, other states have had tax amnesties, have enacted two types of provisions which are intended to have the effect of curtailing future investments in tax shelters. First, they initiate or significantly increase penalties on advisors, sellers, and promoters of tax shelters in an attempt to dissuade their sales of abusive tax shelters in their states. Second, they increase consequences for the taxpayers using abusive tax shelters. They often increase conduct penalties for those persons who did not take advantage of the tax amnesty, and for taxpayers who do not disclose on their tax forms use of certain business devices that can be used as abusive tax shelters. In effect, by imposing a chain of disclosure, there is no longer a guarantee that an abusive tax shelter can be buried inside of a tax return and protected by a conspiracy of silence. The disclosure provisions generally are applicable to tax years subject to the tax assessment process as of the time that the legislation passes. California, Illinois, and most recently New York have enacted tax amnesties which allow settlement of tax shelter issues by paying the tax and under certain circumstances, allowing future tax refund claims in the event that the tax shelter issues are resolved in favor of the tax shelter. That's for those people who are willing to risk litigation as well as those people who can afford it. My footnote 2 is a prominent example of two tax shelters with almost identical fact patterns, where one lost and one won, both of them in the district court in Connecticut. And it turned on very simple facts involving, in one case, a subsidiary of General Electric, and the other case, long-term capital marketing, which you might recall was the subject of a financial bust, I believe, in 97 or 98. In any case, all these states have enacted statutes requiring disclosure of tax shelter participation, and they've also made it very expensive to violate such disclosure requirements. The 2004 Federal Tax Act took penalties to a new height. Failure to disclose penalties results in substantial penalties for reportable and listed transactions. This term, reportable and listed, is defined in the Internal Revenue Code specifically in several code sections and explicitly in regulations under Section 6011-4. Now, these disclosure penalties are not penalties for tax shelter participation. These are penalties for failing to disclose their existence. Now, many tax shelters, if seen in the light of day, will not survive scrutiny. I've scheduled out, best of the sources I have available, the amount of the penalties for the various states and the U.S. in Exhibit A. Now, these penalties are extremely high, and this is due to hearings that have been held before a U.S. Senate subcommittee and also various television news reports that professional advisors intentionally failed to comply with prior laws requiring the registration of tax shelters. They simply viewed these lower penalties as the potential cost of doing business. Now, in my Exhibit B, I have attached several pages from a Senate subcommittee report, with one page specifically listing excerpts from emails where personnel from KPMG deliberately analyzed the cost benefit of penalty versus disclosure and said that they would basically adopt industry practice among the large accounting firms of not complying with tax laws. The one accounting firm, in this case KPMG, believed that penalties, if they were caught, would amount to 14% of the revenues that they receive on the tax shelters. Now, the total fees paid by a tax shelter investor is roughly 7% of the loss claimed, or tax, or rather the tax benefit intended to be claimed. And the 7% fees were basically split between accounting firms, law firms, as well as financial firms that were involved in the organization of these tax shelters. House Bill 2758 does not copy any of the provisions that are in the other state legislations. I can't believe that we intend to make it easy on promoters in this state to carry on with business, even though there are federal limitations now on their practices. I would hope that you reconsider 2758 and are more inclined to go with Senate Bill 480. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deevig. Questions of Mr. York or Mr. Deevig? They both testified on 480 before. Yes, Representative Galizio.
Good afternoon. How would you respond to the claims that enacting, let's say, 480 would have a chilling effect on the business climate in Oregon, and or the claim that the big fish will still get away and you're going to harm, let's say, small business people?
Richard?
Well, I mean, first of all, I believe California's retained fairly low unemployment relative to Oregon for the last few years, and they enacted this thing last year and have just reaped huge benefits from it. Admittedly, some of those are contingent benefits because there are lawsuits, but this idea that somehow getting people to pay what they owe is going to hurt the business climate, to me, does not seem to hold. Because if I had a business today and knew that I was competing with people who found ways to shelter their income or not adequately pay withholding taxes, then I know this doesn't apply. You know, just doesn't seem right to me. Yeah. And we've had a number of our members have been up here who own small businesses. And I think, if anything, not doing equal enforcement and compliance really hurts the business climate.
Mr. York, when you refer to your organization...
Tax Fairness. I forgot to identify myself as a member of Tax Fairness, and I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Follow up. Let's see. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dale, I know your background's at IRS. I know where your expertise comes in. Mr. York, I just don't remember your background.
I'm a retired business guy. Okay. I worked as an executive for the phone company back east.
Okay, great.
I
brought
my son out here.
Further questions of either of these two gentlemen? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Paul, I didn't give you an opportunity to, and maybe this is a good time to do that, just give us a rundown on 2758 and then a kind of a high-level view again of 480.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to go through a little bit of the summary on 2758, it is a general tax amnesty program. So, of course, 480 has two other elements to it. It has a voluntary compliance initiative on abusive tax shelters, and then it has a series of other compliance issues with it. So this is just the general amnesty piece. It does have an amnesty run from January 1, 06 to April 15, 06. I think based on our discussions with the Department of Revenue and Senate Bill 480, this would probably have to be amended because of a conflict with their filing season. So, and that would put staff pressures on the department. It would apply to tax years prior to 2005, which is just the same as your amnesty program in Senate Bill 480. All personal and corporate income taxpayers would be eligible. And anyone who has received or could receive a notice of deficiency would be eligible. And this is a difference with Senate Bill 480, which excludes those who have been issued a notice of deficiency. In other words, if the department's got you in the system, then you're not eligible. And that was a key decision that was discussed at length by the Senate Revenue Committee. But this bill would leave them in, and what that would mean is you'd have considerably more revenue, more gross revenue, but the net wouldn't be much different. Now, I'll show you that in a minute in our estimates, because you'd in effect lose penalty the payments that you would have received otherwise. It would waive all penalties for taxpayers who participate in the program, but it does require that those taxpayers who come forward and pay their back taxes pay interest on those taxes. And it was pointed out in the testimony, it does not have any new penalties going forward as Senate Bill 480 does, so after the amnesty program ends. And as Dell pointed out, there are 40 states that have enacted an amnesty program. Of course, we've talked about California's that was just completed March 31st. And Oregon has had, to my knowledge, really two periods, one in the mid-80s, where there's a wave of amnesty programs, where they discussed seriously an amnesty program and decided on stiffer penalties. Penalties were increased to the level they are now at that point. And again, really, in the special sessions of 2002, there was a further serious discussion at that time, and the decision was to opt for various enforcement efforts to try to speed up collections and increase enforcement. So we are one of the 10 states who has not actually had an amnesty program. Keep in mind that a lot of the amnesty programs you see from the other states and the results are multiple and include sales tax amnesty revenue too. So they're not just income tax.
And those are being very, very effective sales tax, because it's my understanding that when you have a sales tax, someone that comes forward in an amnesty on a sales tax, that's where it stops at the state level. There's no federal sales tax that's tantamount to it. So
that's correct, Mr. Chair. And my experience in working with in a sales tax state in the South was that they would tend to find they would get a lot of use tax revenue, and during when they increased enforcement, because there would be, for example, a business would buy some type of equipment that was taxable and not reported, so they would get a fairly large amount for those individual cases.
Which being the use tax is nothing more than the sales tax after it's been applied to application.
Right, something purchased out of state then brought into the state for use. Mr. Chair, the other things I have are on 480.
Okay.
Should I go through those?
Yes, let's do that, Paul. We've got a number of amendments that are in process, and Paul, I know that you've had folks in the banking community and the legal community and the title company and title community meeting with you. So
the first thing, Mr. Chair, you had asked me to kind of go through the numbers on the revenue impact on 480 and how that was derived. And I am contemplating some changes to that, really based on the recent evidence we've gotten from Illinois, who completed their program on January 31st, and we were not privy to the actual numbers that had come in at that time. But I'll walk through this and tell you where we're looking at some changes that I would have ready for you next week. The Voluntary Compliance Initiative program, we had an estimate of $16.9 million, and this is on this sheet labeled Senate Bill 480 Revenue Impact Numbers. We had an estimate of $16.9 million in gross collections. This was taken from the California experience, and we eliminated the 75% of the revenue. It was over $1 billion, but of the revenue that came in from the VCI, but what came in under appeal. So we were only looking at the 25% that came in without appeal rights. And we based the estimate on that because there isn't any appeal rights in Senate Bill 480 as it is now, but there's some discussion of changing that, and I'll get to that in a minute. In addition, the Department of Revenue has identified $6 million Well, I should say that I took that number and then divided it by 10, as you might expect for Oregon's size difference compared to California, and then adjusted it further downward in the anticipation that we'd have fewer very high-income individuals, because the California participants in the program, they're only several hundred, so it's not a large number, but the amount per return was very large. So we would anticipate in Oregon, and discussions with the Department of Revenue confirm this, that we would probably have proportionally more people, more filers participate, but much smaller average amounts, because we wouldn't have our IPOs and so forth.
Well, the relative size of Illinois compared to Oregon is what?
Mr. Chair, Illinois is almost exactly four times bigger than we are based on personal income. I think we're 24% of Illinois. So getting back to the $6 million, one of the things that we wanted to make sure we did during this during these revenue estimates is not double count. So we wanted to make sure we weren't counting things that we would have gotten anyway. And also we know, and Director Archinko explained to you the collections and enforcement package that's now in the Budget Committee that would add $6 million. This is based on revenue they have identified through contacts with California. So we would assume that would come in anyway. And so I've subtracted that six from the 16.9 gross, added some for new penalties coming in through the year, and then that gives me a VCI net of $11.4 million. Now, if you look at Illinois, and the information we had at the time, Illinois was carrying out their VCI, and I do have their voluntary compliance program in your packets, so it is considered to be considerably less onerous than California's in terms of the penalties and restrictions, but less than 480. But they were anticipating $100 million, and as the chair asked, they're about four times our size, so $25 million, and giving again some adjustment for higher income activity in the Chicago area particularly, I thought the $17 million gross was not out of line. Well, when the numbers have come in, Illinois received $135 million. In addition, they only go back through January of 2000, so they have a shorter look-back period than what we have in Senate Bill 480. So I will be working to update these numbers and probably add in the neighborhood of $5 million to this estimate, based on the Illinois experience. Of course, that will depend ultimately on the amendments that you adopt, but that's what I'm looking at right now based on those Illinois numbers that have come in.
Paul, portions of the Illinois, any multiple filing, well, and that's the concern I've got is that when you've got, again, another relatively high sales tax state with local sales taxes as well. Those that file double or multiple filings, including the other kinds of sales or use taxes, that would certainly affect the numbers of filings, and potentially those that had an opportunity to take advantage of the sales or use tax system might have then felt that gave them license to take advantage of the income tax system. Is that discounted in that process?
I would discount that to some extent because, you know, if you take the $135 million and just take a fourth of that, you're at $32
million. Right.
So I think that's probably too high of an estimate.
Okay.
So I think it should be adjusted down to some extent from that level. The Illinois Department of Revenue reported that they had 700 taxpayers, and they made $135 million in payments. So they do face a 30% penalty for failing to disclose and a 30% penalty on deficiencies. So their penalty structure is vastly different than what we're looking at in Senate Bill 480.
So only 700 taxpayers took advantage of this in Illinois?
That's in fact, Mr. Chair, I can't remember the number Deborah made, but that's more than in California. in terms of the numbers. Remember, this is the VCI part only. This is not the general amnesty. This is the VCI part only. So you have a relatively few taxpayers who tend to have very high income levels who have participated. These are sophisticated taxpayers who participated in these tax shelter programs. They're not the independent contractor who hasn't reported income. They're going to show up in that general amnesty.
So my eBay income and those kinds of
your things. eBay income wouldn't be in there.
Paul, I'm trying to track all this in a hurry. Did you say that the penalties were vastly different or not vastly?
I said they're not vast.
Not vast. Okay. Not vastly, yeah. You said it so fast, I'm going, whoa, what's different?
Okay. They're not vastly different. We have a 20% penalty, but a 40% penalty for multiple transactions.
And they have a 35?
They have a 20 and a 30.
Okay.
And the multiple penalty is as prescribed under 480?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
That's not in existence today.
Right.
All right. Thank you. Representative Riley is recognized. I'm sorry, Paul.
That's okay. What I wanted to ask just very quickly is there any piece in 2758 that would not be included if we did Senate Bill 480?
But Representative Riley, we actually started from a bill pretty similar to 2758 in the Senate Revenue Committee, and so it has been refined and changed in a number of ways. And the biggest difference is, as was pointed out in your testimony, is that 480 does have a post amnesty 25% penalty, and the other difference is that the decision was made by the Senate to exclude those taxpayers who have already been identified. A lot of states will include them, and what happens is you get big numbers because people have a strong incentive already identified to participate, but then you lose revenue in the out years. And what I, you know, if you look at your revenue impact numbers there, I have calculated actually something similar to 2758 because that's the way 480 originally looked. And if you go through the second block, there is the general amnesty program with unidentified taxpayers only. And after netting out interest and penalties and adding in post-amnesty penalties, you would get about a net of $10.1 million. For 0507, and then 200,000 going forward. If you include both of those, you get the 21.4 million, which is your revenue impact for 480 as it currently stands. But then, if you include those that are identified, we would estimate you'd get about another 27 million come in during that 3-month period. But you would have given up about $10 million in interest penalties that you would have gotten because you've already identified them. Okay. Plus, under current law, we assume that most people in the department will tell you most people do pay in full once they've been identified. So you don't get much of a net gain, only $1.8 million, and it actually ends up in a net loss in the out years because you've foregone that revenue you would have collected 2 years down the road. So that was how we looked at it in terms of determining those two, that policy choice, and that's kind of what convinced the Senate to focus on only those taxpayers who have not been identified and are part of the system. But of course, they're the great wild card because we don't have a real good sense of how many are out there and how they'll respond to this.
Only out years, the out years, is that from those states who have from the 80s and those that have participated in the 90s. Is that similar to the experience that they've had, or did they forego those net amnesty revenues through reduced collections through the foregone penalties in other states, or is that unique to 480 in this particular case?
Mr. Chair, I guess my memory is failing me here for a minute, but there was a very good study done on. And I think it was Illinois, but I'm not quite sure I remember that. But there was a very good study done on an amnesty program in the mid-80s, and I based those proportions on that.
Okay, excellent.
So,
when we look at, I guess one of the things that I would caution anyone to look at as you do this, this does accelerate income. This has the tendency of accelerating income into the current biennium. nearly $10 million of which would have been enjoyed in later biennium. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So,
yeah, Representative Hess.
What California did not include the people who had been previously identified?
I don't believe they did. The numbers that I worked with extensively on the general amnesty piece of this were from Michigan. Michigan's 2002 amnesty, in which they did include both, but they did a very good job of differentiating between the two. So I could tell very clearly which group was which. And that's what I used after I scaled down for Michigan size. That's what I used to make the estimates for the general amnesty program. And I just focused on those personal income tax components that were from those who were not identified by Michigan. They had a similar type of presentation like this where they netted out what they thought they would have gotten, which I think is probably the best way to look at their net revenue impact. So those are the estimates as I have now, and I will have, when I have a over the next few days, we'll update that gross collections estimate and net revenue from the VCI based on what 480 looks like now, and then, of course, whatever amendments that you are to put into the bill. The second piece I have is just a brief outline on what this is, what we gave Dexter based on a discussion with members from several industries, the banking community. Bill Manny, who is here, participated from Miller Nash, and Deborah Buchanan was there. And these are the general elements of that discussion, and Bill hasn't seen this, but Deborah has, on the kind of what was discussed in terms of changes, proposed potential changes in Senate Bill 480. The first is to clearly indicate that we are looking at the transactions with no economic substance to them. There's concern over the Section 2 of Senate Bill 480, Section 2, sub C, that refers to the principal purpose of avoiding a tax, and concern that that may be too broad, whereas the language that pertaining to non-economic substance transaction is much better defined. So we're looking at that as part of the amendment. Section 3, there was a lot of discussion around, and this indeed was discussed at length in the Senate as well, on how much discretion should Department of Revenue have. And they have pretty broad discretion in Section 3. And the proposal was to limit their discretion to listed transactions, those that have clearly been identified as abusive, versus reportable transactions, which are those that aren't necessarily going to be subject to a penalty, but which have been deemed as potential. So limit their discretion to listed transactions that would be state-specific, because the other sections of the bill refer to IRS code for listed transaction, reportable transaction. So that's the beginning point. And then how much additional authority should DOR have is the policy issue. And so the amendment would limit those to listed transactions, not reportable, and would be forward-looking only unless the IRS has gone and identified a particular transaction as being listed, and then they go back 5 years and DOR would have that same authority. So they would not be able to look back in the past and say, this is a reportable transaction, should have been reported, and go back 5 years and say, why didn't you report it 5 years ago? So that was the intent.
Representative Berger?
Okay, I think you just answered my question. If it was reportable 5 years ago, they should have reported it, correct?
I think the concern here, Representative Berger, is that the department goes in and lists something as reportable now.
And then looks back
and, then looks back and says,
right. And that's an unfair way of...
Okay. That,
I do understand that.
That was the intent, to make sure that the taxpayers don't unwittingly get
they, you didn't know it was reportable when you did it 5 years ago, and then they come in along and say, oh, but it's reportable now, so you're in, not in compliance.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. There was considerable discussion around the length of time in which the department would be able to look back for abusive transactions. The bill now goes back to 95. It goes back 10 years. And California went back 8 years. Illinois went back 6 years. And the discussion was, the proposed amendment was to use the Illinois look-back period of 6 years, going back to 1/1/99. You know, keep in mind the historical discussion around this and kind of the rise of abusive tax shelters was particularly predominant in the late 90s when the capital gains were so high, because that was a strong incentive to try to shelter income. So the 99-2000 would cover the last 2 years of that stock market bubble period, but it would be limited those 2 years. The other issue that had a lot of discussion was appeal rights. And if you look at Section 15 in the in Senate Bill 480, it says that in line 33, it says a taxpayer may not file a subsequent amended return seeking a refund of tax. So in other words, if you participate in the VCI, you can't go back and change your return. You're in, and there's no changes. So California had an appeals process. Illinois has one in which people would file one of two ways, either with appeal or not. But the suggestion here, and this is the work group has not really had a chance to react to this, and this is based on discussion with the Department of Revenue, but the suggestion here would be to delete that little subsection there, and basically allow individuals who participate in the VCI to file an amended return afterwards, just as they do now under current law. So they would have the same rights as you or I would if we went back and file an amended return 2 years from now. So and Deborah can comment on this, but the concept is to try to establish as much certainty as possible in terms of revenue and to minimize the fiscal impact on the department.
That's on lines 33 through 35 on page 6.
Yes, so that would be just deleted so that there would be no reference to not filing a subsequent amended return. So that would give those that participated in the VCI the right to file an amended return at a later date.
Question.
Rip Sue, yes.
Thank you. It seems to me that I know California had this in place, but it seems like an amnesty is for people who come forward and clean the slate, and that's it. And it's clean slate after that. And I don't understand. I mean, if they're going to do an amended return, wouldn't that be part of the amnesty, the amended return, and therefore we're starting over with a clean slate. We don't have to get the state involved. We don't have to keep appealing these.
Representative Hass, that's certainly true, especially for a general amnesty program, people that haven't filed, for example. But I think that the issue here is that some who have come forward for what are abusive tax shelters, there may be a gray area involved. If there's a post VCI penalty, then they have a strong incentive to come forward, and the concern is that they would lose their right to question whether that's truly an abusive tax shelter or not. So that's the argument.
But wouldn't that be part of the amnesty? I mean, I'm assuming that if someone thinks they've done wrong, they come to the department and they say, here's our stuff, are we okay here? And they say yes or no, or just like any other audit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did discuss that with the department in terms of giving them greater discretion. I think the concern for the department, too, is to tie up a lot of resources in that kind of process. And this was seen as a more direct way to do that, just as you would treat ordinary taxpayers. So, but that's
very much for you to discuss and decide on.
And the discussion seemed to center around the fact that if you started into cross-suing one another over a return where the folks had come forward, and then you allowed or you did not allow any kind of going through the standard appeals process, we began the discussion of perhaps maybe what you're going to get into is you're going to get into lots of Department of Justice fees and a long-term protracted issue here, as opposed to just saying, let's go ahead and resolve it, and they've got their rights at that particular time. One of the things we discussed was that if the department is abusive, then the department picks up both sides of the legal fees, and if the individual files and begins a process of appeal, then fails to prevail in that situation, then the individual would pick up both sides. I think everybody walked away from the table, backed away from the table very carefully at that particular point. We said, rather than going there picking up each other's legal fees, let's just leave them with the same rights they had before they started.
Well, Mr. Chair, in some ways this feels, these are like plea bargains. You're coming forward and you're essentially saying, okay, maybe I did something I wasn't supposed to, and I'll pay a lower penalty than if I would have been caught outright. And when you have a plea bargain, at least in the criminal code, that's it. You plead guilty, that's it. You're not going to appeal that later.
I don't think at that particular point that plea goes away by just filing an amended return, however. I mean, that's still part of the full record at that point. So, they filed the appeal at that particular point only based upon the weights of the relative weights of the case that they may have at that point. That's the way I look at it. In other words, they pled guilty and then come in and say, except for I don't think I am, then that yes. that still is going to weigh. Representative Galizio, question. I'm sorry.
Do I look guilty?
No.
No, well, just listen.
I saw a hand.
I got nothing to shelter.
Scratching you. Not to wait till November 1st. Mr. Chair, just the last couple of elements. There was a number of issues raised around the other compliance components, and the proposal was to, in particular, to delete the non-resident real estate purchase withholding. There wasn't a lot of discussion around local government income taxes, and that's something the committee may want to discuss. Or we do have a number of other bills as well that deal with that. And the tax compliance of occupational license holders. So the direct, simple approach was to delete those sections. The other section a lot of concern on was Section 44, which was we would require that those that get a state license or would be permissive and allow state agencies to require analysis of tax return, tax compliance as a condition of receiving those licenses. So that was the discussion of the group, and we have members of the group here.
Well, let's invite Bill Maniap and Tim, would you like to come forward on behalf of the Oregon Bankers? Okay. Well, welcome, gentlemen. Please go ahead and state your name for the record, and then the issues are before us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim Martinez here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. First of all, I want to thank the chair for putting together a little work group on this issue. Staff does a great job kind of summarizing the discussion of our meeting earlier this week. We think the amendments are going in the right direction. We're still probably needing further work. I mean, we asked a lot of NLC to get them done as quickly as they have. With me is Bill Manny, a partner at Miller Nash, respected tax attorney in Portland, and I'd kind of leave it to him to go through the details and the issues that we discussed, and be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, too. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think a great...
For the record?
Excuse me?
for the record, your name?
Bill Manny.
Thank you.
I think a great deal of progress was made in the recent work group. I think staff points out there's still work to be done with respect to the penalty structure. And staff has pointed out the distinction between listed and reportable transactions, and I guess I would add to that tax avoidance transactions. And I still remain concerned about the differences between these three things, how they're defined, how they're currently used and defined in the federal statutory scheme, and how they're used and defined in this bill. Again, to repeat something that we spoke of earlier this week, reportable transactions at the federal level are simply transactions that the government is concerned about. They are not necessarily bad things. I've done a little bit of research in the 2 days between these meetings, and I find that I still remain concerned about the use of listed transactions in the Act for the same reason. Currently, as the bill is drafted, the failure to avail oneself of the voluntary compliance program with respect to a listed transaction can increase penalties significantly for the taxpayer, and the department has discretion to create its own list of listed transactions. And as I look very carefully, I find still that listed transactions are not the equivalents of tax avoidance transactions. A listed transaction does not necessarily mean it's a bad thing. And I remain concerned about where listed transactions appear in the bill and how they're used, especially with respect to larger penalties. But those are things we're certainly willing to work through and on. The penalty structure concern remains that the penalty structure in this bill appears to be much more onerous for the taxpayer than similar bills in other states, and a very large departure from the penalty structure that the federal code uses with respect to similar things, meaning reportable, listed, and tax avoidance transactions.
The bill, does the federal offer any amnesty?
No, the federal government does not offer amnesty.
Okay, so if they're not offering any amnesty, how can we compare it with the feds?
Well, we can look at the penalties that one receives for not complying with the law with respect to listed, reportable, and tax avoidance transactions. The Internal Revenue Code does not have the level of penalties that we're talking about here. Certainly a policy matter for you folks to decide is the effect to which you believe that more significant penalties cause people to comply. My experience has not been that penalties cause people to comply with the law. Illinois, that had a successful amnesty program, has a 20% penalty. They incorporated a increased interest rate by, in most cases, doubling the effective interest rate, the statutory interest rate. So if one failed to comply, one under the Illinois Amnesty Act would have a 20% penalty and would pay twice or 2.5 times the statutory interest rate on the underpayment. This bill has a series of penalties that could be piled on one another that could be quite horrendous, and I'm not sure the effect to which those penalties help raise revenue and help get people into the compliance program.
Representative Berger, please.
In other words, you don't think the penalties help if they're too onerous? Is that what you're saying? You're not convinced that the penalties are going to make a difference?
Yes. I don't. I know that there is a report in some of the background of this bill that taxpayers sometimes look at penalties and they say, well, that's not such a bad penalty. I'll just deal with it if it happens, and I'll make a business decision that I'll pay the penalty. It doesn't take a very significant penalty when you compile interest, and especially if you were to, for example, follow Illinois' suit and increase the effective rate of interest to get to a substantial economic detriment for a taxpayer not to comply. There's a rule in the calculation of interest called the rule of sevens that at 7% interest over 10 years doubles the amount, you know, is 100%. Often when we interact with non-complying taxpayers that are several years behind when they should have filed, they either didn't report something properly or they didn't file, we are often faced with interest, even at the statutory existing rates, with negligible penalties, and by negligible penalties, I mean penalties in the 20 to 25% range that exist already on the books. It's very easy to get to 100% of the tax you owe and more.
That's a very good follow-up.
Yes. While we're discussing the Illinois experience, what other states certainly have had some good success with this, and they have used, I presume, and maybe this is a question for Paul, some sort of listed transaction. And what I understand you to say is that you're uncomfortable with reportable, and there's been discussion about taking reportable out of here and leaving listed and use the federal list. But I also hear you implying that there's some other list out there that other states might have used that you're more comfortable with, and I just would like to kind of have a...
No, my concern about listed remains that as the bill is written, the department still has the ability to create a listed transaction for the state of Oregon. The Illinois bill, for example, follows the federal list for a listed transaction and seeks these heightened penalties and supporting on tax avoidance transactions.
Okay.
So while we've pared back through the definitions because we've gotten rid of reportable, I think we still need to look at whether listed works the way we've got it in this bill effectively and whether it reflects what other states have done in terms of effectiveness.
Okay.
And part of that concern clearly goes to concern about the department having to administer these definitions and administering these definitions. Illinois and California, New York, much bigger states, much bigger departments of revenue, and the federal government is already doing a pretty effective job at creating lists of listed transactions, reportable transactions, and tax avoidance transactions or tax shelters in the federal code.
Okay.
Further questions? Representative Ask.
You primarily focused on the abusive tax shelter component of Senate Bill 4A. Is that where your concern is?
I think we should stay focused on things that are bad. And as it's currently drafted, tax avoidance transaction is clearly a bad thing. A listed transaction may or may not be. So I'm a little concerned about heightened penalties on listed transactions, which may or may not be a bad thing.
Well, can you, Mr. Chair, are you speaking now as a banking community, a lawyer who represents high net worth people? Or
I'm here representing U.S. Bank Corp. So I guess I'm part of the banking community to the extent they have thrown me in to represent the banking community's interests.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, if I could answer your question directly, the VCI piece is the one that we're concerned about. As I understand, in the Senate, the bill was amended on the amnesty piece to just be for personal tax returns, not corporate. So we are here on the VCI portion. And while we're here representing the Bankers Association, I can tell you there are others in this building who have similar issues with the VCI portion as well.
Did you want to continue, Bill, or were you?
Well, if I could just add back on Mr. Martinez's comments, I think, again, the concern is the policy issue with respect to how much extra penalty and power you need to give the department in order to make the amnesty piece work in this particular area. And what we're seeing is experiences of several other states that didn't have to have these broader definitions, the broader discretion, and the substantial penalties in order to have an effective amnesty program in the voluntary compliance piece.
Okay, further questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment. Although we see these other states who had a successful program without these higher penalties, we don't know how much more successful they would have been with these penalties, do we?
I agree. I can't tell you except that I never have a client come in that has a problem and hear them say, I'm concerned about the penalties I have to pay. Most taxpayers I have represented that have been in their past non-compliant actually had no idea of the penalty level and are always quite shocked even at the, what I consider to be the nominal penalties we have in comparison to this bill when I tell them how much in penalty and interest, even under the, without increasing any of the penalties, without looking at Senate Bill 480, most taxpayers that are several years behind on paying a liability are going to pay more than twice the tax because of the penalties and the interest.
Yeah.
Most of them are shocked to find that out.
Mr.
Was that responsive, Representative?
Well, a quick follow-up, if I may.
Please.
Part of that will be taken care of, I hope, by marketing this plan so that people become very aware of what they face if they don't comply.
Thank you. Representative
I just had to comment. Representative Olson is not here, but I can guarantee you when he pulled somebody over on the freeway, they were pretty shocked about the penalties for their speeding ticket, too. It isn't until you make the mistake that the penalties become an issue.
The truth is that compliant people are reading the law and understand those things, and non-compliant people are generally not paying attention to any of those penalties and fines and issues until they're caught.
Well, I venture to guess that if I pulled 10 people off of the street and asked them if they'd made a mistake that they owed $10 on the 1998 tax return, what do you think they'd owe today? Some would say, you know, $11 or $12. Very few would say, you know, $30 or $40, which is, you know, likely what it's going to be. So at that particular point, it's very difficult to come back and have folks recognize. I mean, whether they're compliant or not, it's just those things, it's like you say, Bill, the rule of sevens, pretty soon that catches up with you, and it's a lot of money. Thank you. Further questions of these gentlemen?
I have some questions, Paul.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Were these same issues raised on the Senate side? In the Senate side?
Representative Boquist, that there was a fair amount of discussion about the discretion on the part of the department and whether there should be flexibility to go beyond what's in the IRS code. So, and then there was some desire to look at the decision was to give them some authority for state kind of specific abuses that may take place. The penalty issue was also discussed. We did work more closely, certainly with the California model than we did with the Illinois model in the Senate. And the decision was to have a stick that was pretty significant, and that was the way they designed it.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Let's see, Representative Greg McPherson. Representative Kirsten, you have amendments A8 and A9. Do we know anything about the A7 amendments which have been handed out?
That's the Department of Revenue.
Yeah.
That's from the Department of Revenue?
Those are the Department of Revenue ones and the ones that were discussed by Paul under the voluntary compliance section there.
Okay.
The previous discussion. They just arrived in my office, like when the meeting was already started.
Okay.
Okay, so the A7s are Department of Revenue.
But, yeah, those are technical amendments. They're not based on the discussion you just heard about.
Okay.
We don't have, those are the dash 10s that we don't have.
Okay, all right, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Greg McPherson, House District 38. I appreciate the chance to come and present on a couple of sets of amendments here. I wanted to comment on not really on the voluntary compliance initiative. I think you're getting some good input. I had developed a bill that was a separate bill that had started out here on the House side that had these features in it, but I think that there's some pretty useful input you're getting as to the fine-tuning of how an effective voluntary compliance initiative ought to go forward, and I think that this is a very positive process. I would offer up my efforts and whatever expertise I could bring to that to the work group that you've been invited to look in on these things, and would be happy to work with them further on those issues. What I wanted to focus on is on the other tax compliance features that are part of Senate Bill 480, and particularly react to the suggestion in the outline of amendments that sections 32 through 46 would be deleted. And I think that there would be some useful things that would be lost to the public good in Oregon if we were simply to take those out. I wanted to focus on each of several pieces. One of them is on the real estate withholding piece. You may recall that from a prior presentation I made that this is a feature of the bill that was based on the law in Colorado, and actually a number of states have a required withholding of real estate of tax at the point of closing on sales of local real estate by out-of-state sellers of property. And in response to concerns that have been expressed and some discussions that I've had with a constituent of mine who's the head of a title company, I have prepared the Dash 8 amendments, which would change this from a withholding requirement to a reporting requirement. It would require that the report of transaction that's made to the IRS would be made to the Oregon Department of Revenue so that we can gather information to determine what the scope of the problem is. One of the comments that's been made to me or questions is to say, well, what is there a real problem here? And I'd have to say, we don't know what the scope of the problem is. We know that it's a sufficient problem that a number of other states have instituted this kind of withholding and that they do regularly collect a significant withholding tax as a result. But we don't know what the scope of the problem is in Oregon, and what the Dash 8 amendments would do is they would require that on any conveyance more narrowly defined than it is in the engrossed version of Senate Bill 480, that is a transfer of deed by fee simple estate and real property located in the state, there would be a requirement of the same report that's made to the IRS to be sent to the Department of Revenue, so we can start to gather information to determine what the scope of the problem is. And I think, too, just as a result of an obligation to report and the knowledge by a seller that that reporting is occurring, we will probably have a positive effect on conduct as well, because I think for a lot of people who are who realize they have a tax obligation in another state, the probability of that state's taxing authority pursuing the issue and at least the knowledge of that that taxing agency probably has an impact on their conduct. And recognize that for a lot of people who are located in, you know, residing in states that have a local, a state income tax in their state of residence, they may well feel as though they're paying that income tax to their state, and they just assume their state got it rather than Oregon. There would be a state tax credit generally where that occurs. We just want to make sure that Oregon gets what's owed to Oregon, so that out-of-state taxpayers will recognize that they have that obligation. So I would urge you to go with the Dash 8 amendments as a lesser kind of version of the real estate withholding piece.
Representative Bird?
Yeah, if you're ready to move on to the next thing, I have a question here on this one,
please.
If you wouldn't mind. Is there any penalty in this for if they do not report? I haven't had a chance to read it, and it's...
Yes, and I just got the Dash 8 amendments here and a couple of hours ago, and there is no stated penalty here, and so that, I guess there's an open question about whether there is generally for failure to a fairly nominal penalty for failure to report on real estate or on any reportable kind of a transaction, anytime that there's a required 1099 form reporting in the IRS's system, there's a fairly nominal penalty. And whether there is in Oregon for a failure to make this filing, I can't tell you. And perhaps there, and perhaps that's an item that should be considered.
Yes, and I'm sure we'll hear from the Department of Revenue on how this right. would work, and I would anticipate
I guess
that and, question might come up.
Thank you. And looking at the Dash 8, you've got authorized agent doing closing and settlement services with a conveyance. So if there's a conveyance, authorized agent providing the closing statement services in connection with the conveyance shall report the conveyance to the Department of Revenue if... Number one, the conveyance is required to be reported to the Internal Revenue Service. Now, so far as I know, authorized agents, closing agents, escrow closing agents, any time that they are involved in a conveyance, a closing statement, they are presently required to file the Form 1099 information return for a sale, a 1099-S, or a brokerage if it's a personal property, and which would be a 1099-B. And number two or B is not if there is a report is not required to report to the Internal Revenue Service, and the agent shall report the information that would have been reported to the Internal Revenue Services to the department. So I guess in that regard, I'd look to the land title folks, and we have Jack Monroe here from the land title association, and they will have him up in just a bit. But I'm not, and you're an attorney, counselor, so representing McPherson, I don't know of any closings that they do where there is a conveyance that they're not required to report it. So I'm going to guess that there's already a report. In that regard, then we've got the Department of Revenue is already accessing or capable of accessing the 1099 data directly. I posed that question to the department earlier this week, and have this response. The department currently receives 1099 data directly from the IRS for Oregon resident taxpayers. We do not at this time receive IRS data for non-resident taxpayers, but that may change in the near future. Now, it's any closing statement that is generated, I assume. Let's see, this agent must be a real estate agent. I'm assuming this is within Oregon. Representative McPherson, is that your understanding?
That's certainly my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Of course, the 1099s that are presently required by the Internal Revenue Service are required of all taxpayers and all closing agents everywhere, no matter what their address is. So you might have an Oregon resident closing a transaction in Nevada, and that information is available on a 1099 coming out of a closing agent from Nevada. That's all, again, already required by the Internal Revenue Service. So, but it's as to a non-resident, if it's closing of an Oregon property and title insurance is involved, I don't know. There's a lot of questions there. Jack Monroe, would you like to come forward and help us kind of dig through that? Because I think this reporting requirement probably help jump over some of the hurdles, but I'm not sure that you're not already doing what's required here.
So let's see if we get somebody who has more expertise than I have. Yeah. I'd have to say, Mr. Chair, this is not my area of professional practice.
For the record, Jack Monroe, representing the Oregon Land Title Association, and this will be a short comment because I don't understand this process at this level either. And you have identified it. I obviously just had an opportunity to take a look at this amendment. You have identified the questions that I intend to put to those who know this better than I, meaning what is now reported and required to be reported under the 1099-S or 1099 process, what isn't, and you know, you've added, Mr. Chair, a different dimension, which is the fact that a lot of that information is already available, is already apparently resident at the Department of Revenue, in which case this would be a duplication and an additional expense that would be incurred by the parties who are required to do it. So, I mean, obviously we need to sort out the mechanics of what's being suggested here.
Okay, the response from the department goes on to say that we are authorized under current law to require filing a 1099 information directly from the department or directly with the department for those types of transactions. However, even in cases where we have the information and know a sale has occurred, our ability to collect is sometimes limited when we're dealing with non-resident who fails to file or pay the tax. So that would get back to some method of withholding. However, once you know that a transaction has taken place in Oregon, again, that 1099 information either is available off of the federal database that's provided to us, or presently we are authorized to collect that information under current law. So I don't know, Representative McPherson, if that's if that would require then this to happen. And again, it says they shall report it, and I don't know of any transaction that's being closed by a closing agent, either for either with a sale taking effect, because the federal law provides that 1099-S on all transactions are over $600. The 1099s are required, and then if there's interest involved, then there's additional forms, information returns that are required as well. So I think there's some good questions there, and we'll just need to follow up on those. But it may be that the department already has access to some of the information, or, according to the information here, may have the ability to require the filing of form information directly with the department for these types of transactions, may have that authority now. So,
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the input from the industry. We'll certainly welcome that. We don't want to create something that's an unreasonable burden, and it was in that spirit that I was suggesting that we replace the withholding requirement. But because the one policy issue I would emphasize is that the reporting of information to a taxing agency does shape conduct. I feel confident of that because I've seen it play out in other areas in my own law practice. And I think that simply existing access to information through the IRS, for example, isn't the same as an affirmative report that is made on the closing transaction, because that is more likely to be known by the taxpayer who owes that tax and resides in another state.
It'd be interesting, Jack, to have the land title industry identify what kind of information is given to someone about, because you sign a separate series of forms, not just the W-9 and the W-4 and all of those kinds of things that show that you pay your taxes, that you're not a foreign resident, all of those kinds of things. If any of that information that they sign up in an escrow office when they're closing any kind of transaction, if any of that says that this will also be available to the state of Oregon. We all assume that it goes to the Internal Revenue Service. They know everything we know about ourselves and a little bit more. So, and if you go by that philosophy, you don't have to worry about any of this VCI and amnesty and all of that.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. And what I've in my professional and I would say my personal experience, just observing and talking to other people, there really are different kinds of people. There are some people who assume that all information is known to the taxing authorities, and they, by golly, they better do what they're supposed to do, and they do for that reason and because they realize it's the right thing to do. And there's some folks who don't think that way, who respond to when they see a prospect that they're going to be tagged with a penalty, and that's what motivates them. And it's unfortunately it's we have to design our tax system so that we encourage and motivate the people who are in that latter camp.
I think that's one of the most discouraging things about practicing accounting is that sometimes you'll only see folks once a year practicing taxation. When you see them come back next year, as you're going through their information, you'll find out that they paid a bill to the IRS or the Department of Revenue. You say, "What's that?" And they said, "They sent me a bill. I paid it. I must owe it." He said, well, you know, do you have a copy of it? Keep a copy of it? Frequently, when you find a copy of it, it wasn't, very frequently, well, it wasn't something that they in fact owed. Besides that, when the federal sends them something, if they really did owe it, it isn't very long before they hear from the state of Oregon. And the state of Oregon sends it out and says, listen, you paid the federal $100, you must owe us $10.
Why not me? Yeah.
Plus the interest. And besides that, the interest isn't just up to the time that you paid the to the feds, it's now 3 months longer. And so they pay that bill too. So I you know, that's very, so some folks just say, hey, that's the government, and they are right, and they know, so I guess I'll pay it.
But if I could note that in this case, the report wouldn't be telling people they owe something. All I'd be doing is saying there is a, be telling the Department of Revenue some real estate located in Oregon was sold, so that they can then match that up with a tax return to see whether it was reported as a transaction on which there is a capital gain.
And again, that 1099-S that they will receive in the mail from the agency that's closing that at the end of the year, it's assumed, because that shows that there's three copies of that, one to the individual, one to the agency, and the taxing department. It would be assumed that maybe some of that does get shared, but presently it's my understanding that 1099 is shared in the database with the federal and doesn't necessarily, unless requested by the department or reviewed by the department, because the department, I think, shares the information directly, but whether or not they access it, and I met earlier today with the director, and it all comes down to how much you want to put in, how much you want to invest in it. The tools are already in the toolbox. How much do you want to put into it? And that comes back into the fiscal. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know that she used that word directly, but she did say, you know, we've got some work that we can be doing on this. So. Yes,
Might I simply raise one other issue? And that is, as the discussion has moved along, I think the exercise is to try and figure out where the gaps might be. And the representative has said, and we've acknowledged, that some of this information is already resident in the Department of Revenue and apparently satisfies the objective that the representative has here, which is to, while we don't know there's a problem, obviously the suggestion was there, we need to collect some information to see if there's a problem. But I would add that this sort of standard language in sub 3 of this amendment, which is to essentially give the Department of Revenue rulemaking authority to expand on the nature of the report, I can see that becoming a potential problem for us if this somehow morphs into something other than an exchange of 1099-related information. Because understand, if we have to, regardless of how big the gap is, essentially have to construct our own process, collect information other than that which is exchanged in 1099, we're going to incur an expense, and there will be resistance certainly to doing that.
Particularly, the information is already being gathered. It's just the
But I mean, again, this grants the Department of Revenue the authority to expand the scope of whatever information is being exchanged, and that would translate into cost. And as I say, we'll not be excited about that potential.
Sure.
Go ahead, Representative.
Well, I'll just say that subsection 3 was not something specifically requested. I think that was something developed, I think, at least at a council in aid of kind of the more generalized request that I had made, and I'm certainly open to that input from.
Thank you. And Representative Riley's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things we've talked about, two kinds of taxpayers here, those who as soon as they think something's reported will automatically do the right thing, and those who, if they see that it's reported, may or may not. And one of the things that I see that we're doing here is we're forgetting about those, that third kind of taxpayer, who the only way they will do anything is if we have their money and they want some of it back. And I think that's where we were going in the beginning, and we're trying to avoid some hassle for these folks collecting that, but those are the taxpayers that we were thinking about originally, I believe.
I think that was, and that's why the proposal was, and it just went away, because you know, potentially it could be collecting 4% on billions of dollars worth of sales, and at that point I'd say send the money to me, and I'll be responsible to make sure those people report. Give me the access to the database that I've got in the Internal Revenue Service, and I'll send the money back every year, a year later. Mm-hmm. So, okay, and dash A9, Representative,
right.
Or did you want to?
If I maybe just sort of going in the order in which they appear in the bill, if I could comment on some a feature that doesn't have an amendment associated with it, but I did want to comment on it. There is the feature of Senate Bill 480, which is local government income taxes. It's sections 35 through 42. As you may recall, the thrust of this proposal was that when requested by a local government that has income taxing authority, and if that local income tax queues up quite precisely with the Oregon income tax, then the Department of Revenue would become the collection agent for it, so that instead of having a whole separate filing process, which was true, for example, of the iTax in Multnomah County, instead it would be simply a one-line item, in addition to tax, that is on the Oregon Form 40 with an instruction. And it's a pure good government kind of proposal, but it's part of the general theme of improving income tax compliance. Because to have a whole separate level of reporting and separate forms and a separate definition of income is really an astonishingly inefficient way to go about accomplishing the purpose.
Did you convey that to Multnomah County Commissioner?
I have on several occasions.
I think staff's position was, and I agree, is that there are a number of vehicles that could accommodate local government in the process that will have a separate revenue or a separate fiscal impact as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that there are some modifications that the department was working on, which would essentially eliminate the fiscal impact of this feature of the bill. I know there was a significant fiscal impact that was related, I think, just to the timing consideration. That is, that there might be an upfront investment made to accommodate a local government, and that without the revenue coming in within the same biennium. And as I understand it, the department has some changes that would solve that problem. And given that it could be solved that way, and given that we're at the point in the session we are, I would urge you to, since it is under the general theme, improving the collection of income taxes in Oregon, that we ought to leave it in this vehicle, because I think it's entirely consistent with with the general policy statement, which is pretty simple one, which is that people who owe their income taxes in Oregon ought to pay them. So I would urge you not to just toss that one out, saying, well, gee, there's another way to accomplish it, because at this late date it may be hard to do.
Well, I'm concerned about the fiscal, which I received yesterday at nearly $1.5 million.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say, and if that were the true fiscal on it, after the appropriate amendments are made, I would stand shoulder to shoulder with you to oppose passing it.
Okay.
But if we can solve that fiscal problem, which I understand we can, I would urge you to leave it in this vehicle, because I think this is the appropriate way to move it. Then the last item that I was going to comment on is the Dash 9 amendments, which address the changes which are in sections or provisions that are in sections 43 and 44 of the Act, which are the Senate Bill 480A, which is tax compliance of occupational license holders. The language of this is pretty broad, and this has generated some resistance because of its breadth. And so I had asked Legislative Council to prepare the Dash 9 amendments in order to focus more precisely and mechanically on what I had understood we were really trying to accomplish here, which is to have to authorize the Department of Revenue to request that a licensing agency board or commission of the state obtain a tax identification number from the people who have or applying for or are holding an occupational or professional license, so that the Department of Revenue can do a match to make sure that that individual is in fact filing a tax return. It's not to turn the licensing board or agency into a tax auditing agency to see whether they're actually reporting the correct amount of income. It's really just to catch the people who are completely off the books, which is a problem for some people who hold licenses. So the aim here in the Dash 9 amendments is to, what it does is it authorizes the Department of Revenue to request an agency board or commission that issues occupational licenses, professional licenses, to require the licensee or applicant to provide the taxpayer identification number of the licensee or applicant, and then to submit that information to the Department of Revenue. And if the department determines that the licensee or applicant did not file an Oregon income tax return for the most recent tax year, then I'm paraphrasing here, the department shall notify the agency or commission of the department's determination, and upon that notification, the agency shall revoke any previously issued license or not renew a license. And then there's a carve-out. Unless the license applicant or renewal applicant establishes to the satisfaction of the agency board or commission that the failure to file was due to reasonable causes, so then there's an opportunity for the licensee to come in and show there was a good reason for this, or B, the applicant or renewal applicant establishes to the satisfaction of the agency that the applicant is in compliance with all income tax filing return filing requirements. So in other words, to show either they had filed in fact or there was a good reason why they didn't file. And really the policy choice here is simply to say to our people who are receiving valuable licenses, the privilege to do business in Oregon in an occupation or profession, that they in fact are paying the income taxes that are being generated from that activity.
What does it require? I noticed that it talks about taxpayer identification number of licensee under in the first part of the section under subparagraph 1. What are those agencies which presently do not request a taxpayer ID number?
It would only be triggered by a request from the Department of Revenue that this be done. So others that are not, and in response to that, then the agency would then need to start obtaining that information.
At the request of the Department of Revenue?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Only triggered
What of the Department of Transportation and ODOT? Would they then be required to do that for their licensees?
I don't know if those would be considered occupational or professional licenses.
They're not, but they are licensees under the state. I'm just wondering how far that goes. You do have CDLs that are part of that.
It was not intended to extend beyond occupations or professions.
Okay.
I guess I'm not reading this like I think maybe the amendment doesn't mirror what you might have asked for, because it looks to me like sub one says that every state agency, board, or commission that issues an occupational license. Just as an aside, the Employment Department maintains a list of occupational licenses. There are 260 plus licenses. There are probably, because there are some boards, commissions, and agencies that issue more than one license, there are probably in the excess of 100 of these agencies that are out there. I did not bother to count all of the boards, commissions, and whatnot. And, you know, they range from doctors and lawyers to tattoo artists and everything in between. But the way I read this, sub 1 says each of those 100 and however many boards are that will ask each of their licensees for their number. And it looks to me like sub 2 says that those agencies will submit that ID at whatever the renewal cycle is to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue will respond by saying, you know, they filed the tax return. Mm-hmm. The issue that I would raise, I guess, for you is the following. I don't understand the logistics of this and what it might mean. How many members of the bar are there?
There are about active members. There are about 7,000 or 8,000.
7,000 or 8,000 members of the bar, one of the boards. We renew on an annual basis. So at some point in time, approaching that renewal, apparently the Department of Revenue will get 7,000 taxpayer ID numbers, you know, one for for each attorney. You know, you multiply that out among the 100 and some different boards, commissions.
Some of those lawyers,
you know,
whatnot,
you know, I have no idea what the fiscal is, but on either end of it, meaning that the bar, you know, they'll have to. It'll cost them something to send the list, and it'll certainly cost Department of Revenue somebody something to process it. And again, you know, magnify that out among the 100 and some that you have. So it just seems to me it looks to me like you need to examine the mechanics of how this all might work and what the nature of the burden might be and what the fiscal implications might be on each of those boards, commissions, and
Mr. Chair, I welcome that input, and I'm looking at Section 44 sub 1 as amended by the A9 amendments. I have to say what I had asked for, which was that this be triggered by a request from the Department of Revenue to a particular agency, board, or commission. I don't see that language.
Yeah, the state shall and the commission.
Yeah, it looks like it's made shall.
Yeah, and that was clearly not the intention, and I received these A9 amendments just, say, a couple of hours ago.
Isn't it great, to take a look at what you've got versus what Representative Oakley's recommending?
Along the same thing on the page, too, Representative McPherson, when you go back to the Legislative Council, the way I read this, it also says that, I mean, you could be, we'll use the lawyer example since it was brought up. I mean, a lawyer may still be licensed by the bar and semi-retired and living in Arizona most of the year without income or whatever it may be, and not required. I mean, if you're not required to file with the state, how is the state bar going to determine that, you know, lawyer X didn't make any money? He was a bad lawyer and he didn't make a bunch of investments, so he doesn't even have an investment income, and he has zero income for the year. And so he's not required to file. I mean, it doesn't. We're telling the agency to go out and figure out whether the individual was required to file. So I think that needs to be addressed. How is that mechanism going to work? Because the Department of Revenue is going to go out and, doesn't say in here, the Department of Revenue is going to go out and find out that, well, he didn't make any income because they sent him a letter that says you didn't file. Why didn't you file? He says a lot of banks didn't make any money, so I'm not required to file. Now what do we do?
Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, I appreciate that input. The way I can would imagine that would work is that there's other information in the database, including place of residence, it's true that there are licensed members of the Oregon Bar who do not reside in Oregon. They engage in Oregon law, so they become licensed in Oregon, but they don't actually practice physically here and probably not subject to the laws of the income tax of Oregon by virtue of the income they're generating, and so those people probably would be screened out so that you'd be focusing on the people who are licensed, actively licensed attorneys in Oregon, residing in Oregon. But I would say as to that population, that there are some significant costs for a person to have an active license to practice law in Oregon, including contributions into the professional liability fund. So it would be a pretty unusual case that you would have somebody who has an active bar license and is not, in fact, generating any income from it because they're paying for insurance coverage that they're not using. So I would say that would raise a sufficient red flag to me that it would be appropriate to then go to the next level to say, okay, then demonstrate that you, in fact, have met your income tax filing obligations.
Who makes that request? Representing person.
It would be
a demonstration request.
It would be the licensing agency upon request from the Department of Revenue.
So then the licensing agency would come back to the attorneys, all attorneys who did not file income tax returns after they've received the Social Security numbers, and ask them to identify under what name or number they have filed their Oregon income tax return for the subject year. Or why they hadn't if they didn't.
Chair Butler, the furnishing of information from the licensing agency to the Department of Revenue then would result in a cross-check, you know, comparing the tax ID numbers for individuals who had filed returns with this list of people who are probably obligated to file a return, and anybody who doesn't match up right, then that would the Department of Revenue would then have the authority to then take that number back or that information back to the licensing agency. Now, it could refine that information. It could screen out all people who, by some, based on some other cut, based on, for example, place of residence, and take them out of the mix. Then that were then put to the next demonstration, which is to show that they are in fact meeting their income tax obligations.
Representative Berger.
Representative McPherson, I'm having a philosophical disconnect here, and you and I have discussed this a little bit, but my fundamental question is, when we issue these kinds of licenses, lawyers, doctors, real estate, whatever the profession, is this the appropriate question that we want answered in the licensing process? You've also filed your taxes. I mean, we want to know, is the public protected? Are you adequately trained? Are you capable of... Our sort of philosophical basis here is we are protecting the public and setting some standards that the public can depend on. And I'm not sure that filing your taxes is part of that, or adequately filing your taxes or timely reporting your taxes, or whether we want to spend a lot of tax dollars determining that, because the more important question for me is the first ones, do you have the minimum certifications for this? Are we then presenting to the public that you are certified to be a member of the bar, doctor or whatever, and I'm having a tough time getting over that when we're talking about that this particular issue. And
Chair Butler, Representative Berger, I appreciate the comment, and it's a policy decision that it's for you folks to make. I'm comfortable with it, I have to say. We confer a very valuable right on, say, a lawyer in Oregon to be able to solicit business from the public and to provide that professional service and to generate an income from it. And the policy choice I would make is to say it's not an unreasonable thing to do to condition that right on a demonstration that the individual has filed a tax return. Other people could disagree as a policy matter, and I would defer to your decision if you decide that this is a feature of the compliance package you'd rather leave out. It's not one that I would feel as strongly about as some other features, but I think that, to my mind, it's a reasonable policy choice.
Thank you. Mr. Monroe.
Additional comment, though, relative to Representative Berger's query, and I wouldn't disagree with Representative McPherson that it's a policy choice, but I would refer you, I guess, to the revenue statement that was provided at least with the last bill, and the conclusion I think that your staff arrived at was that neither of these sections are revenue generators. They might well be. They might speed up a stream of revenue, but they don't generate revenue, at least based on what you can now discern. And so I think that makes more significant your question, and that is, how much money do we want to spend on the implementation of either of these two sections and for what purpose? I mean, this is a bill that, as I understand it, was designed to encourage tax compliance. And it would seem that neither of these two ideas necessarily do that. I mean, their data collection or some of the purposes is underpinning them, and they don't necessarily add to the revenue stream that you're apparently looking for.
Relative to sections 43 and 44, tax compliance of occupational license holders, one of the items that was entered into the record was that the inference in the past has been that the bar has been highly problematic. In meeting with Director Archenko, she took that information from some years back, recognized that the Department of, or the Internal Revenue Service, had a special audit program for lawyers, auditing, I think, used car dealers, lawyers.
I didn't know that was going
to happen. Ouch. Yeah.
And cab drivers. But it was found, Director Archenko, and in all fairness, she's a holder of one of those licenses from the bar indicated that the bar license holders were not necessarily more problematic than other professional licensees. So my idea to apply only a pilot program to lawyers only would not work. It wouldn't generate. but in all fairness, though, Director Archenko feels like that some of the tools, particularly with regard to certain license holders and certain agencies that she's presently working with, she has some tools in the bucket right now. And the concern is, can we make those work? Can we within the regular audit cycle, apply these kinds of things to those agencies which already require federal ID as is prescribed and discussed here in the A9 amendment. I'm concerned, you know, we went out a couple of years ago and asked people for Social Security numbers to get fishing licenses or hunting licenses, and you know, I don't know that I would do that two times to people who carry guns in their cars and stuff like that. I think we had a kind of a bad experience at that point, and I think the director's point is well taken, and that is, I have some tools in my tool chest right now. Let me use and work with those, and then as we see how to maybe manage that within the current licensing program, then we may come back and take another look at that. And I think you'll agree, Representative McPherson, that maybe the A9s don't do everything exactly the way that you had hoped that they would come out.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that comment. I hadn't studied them closely, and I think that they don't accomplish just what I had requested, as is typical. I think the other people probably had that same experience.
Yeah, if you were the first person that came forward and said, hey, please don't do exactly what I'd ask, I'd be shocked.
Maybe a closing comment, I would say, the comment was just made about this not producing an identifiable revenue increase, I think, is right, and I would urge you not to try to count in dollars from these kinds of sources. I think that it is there's a positive thing we achieve for the culture of tax compliance when we improve the mechanisms that encourage people to perform better in that area, however, and I think that that's a positive thing. That I think that to the extent that there's a sense among the public that while they're paying, other people aren't, that tends to break down the culture of compliance. And so I think that things that generally assure or create a greater probability that tax liabilities will be paid protects our overall system. And so I think it is wise to look at obviously the fiscal impact of each thing that's being discussed and the impact on the particular industry. And I'd be happy to work further with the land title people that I have already about that particular proposal. But I think that these are ideas that ought to be have merit. I think that would be in the mix among the three ideas that I've discussed here. I would say the local income tax piece is the piece I think it's most important, because that's I think if properly designed can be done with so it has no negative revenue impact to the state, and I think really will solve a problem that we've seen play out here in the last couple of years.
In that regard, Councillor or Representative McPherson, one of the things that I would be concerned about is that would only allow access to the State Department of Revenue as a collection source. Those municipal agencies who, number one, exactly mirrored the state's taxation system, which right now would kick out Multnomah County, and number two, as it's presently written, only have taxes of 1% or less, which would also kick out Multnomah. So I'm concerned as to how much more mandating we want to do if local governments would like to have access to that, then they wouldn't have access to the program.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on those points. This doesn't mandate the local governments to do anything. They have whatever taxing authority they have. It just tells them that if they queue theirs up with the state system in a precise way that doesn't create a bigger burden than a certain level, that then they can piggyback on the state collection system. And the 1% limit was put in intentionally to avoid having
it become a really large component of what the state is doing, so that it really is a piggyback, it's an add-on. So I think it works pretty well in the way designed, if the timing issue is solved, which I understood the department was working on. In any event, I appreciate your patience in hearing me present on these items.
Representative Hess.
Thank you. I just wanted to give some points to Representative McPherson for bringing these amendments forward and trying to address some concerns that were raised here. And I certainly echo his sentiment in trying to improve the culture of tax compliance. I don't see this bill necessarily as a revenue raiser as much as I see it as sort of improving the citizenry, and so that the little people know that the big shots are paying their fair share, because when that starts to break down, then we're in real trouble. So.
You know, I think that's a point very, very well taken, and still recognizing that our system is a voluntary assessment system too, and we come dangerously close to the edge of that each time we tell a director to go collect another $20 or $40 million in exchange for 5 or 10 more auditors. I'm very concerned how close we continue to push that envelope as a legislative assembly. Further questions, comments of this group here?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a very good discussion.
And we'll invite now. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Deborah Buchanan, please, from the department. And if I've misspoken, Deborah, please feel free to just clean my plow. Clean my plow. She's coming up here with gloves on.
No, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, you never say anything wrong that I have heard. So,
can you talk to my wife?
Mr. Chairman, there was discussion earlier about reportable transactions, listed transactions, and the penalties, and I just wanted to take just a few minutes to address that so there's no confusion, unless I'm the one that's confused. If a taxpayer engages in a reportable transaction, and those are defined in federal law, there's a regulation. It lists 6 categories of transactions that are considered reportable transactions. If the taxpayer discloses on the return the fact that they engaged in a reportable transaction, there's no penalty associated with the transaction.
Now, Deborah, they presently do that. They're presently required to report that on the reportable transaction on a special form on the federal.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Does the state get a copy of that, or what's the similar program for?
We
state?
Should get a copy of it, Mr. Chair. We don't necessarily get.
Then do you feed back off of the information from the federal return?
Yes.
Okay.
But if we don't get the form, we don't know. But again, if they don't disclose the transaction, that's when the penalty comes in. It's not the fact that they engaged in the transaction. It is that they didn't disclose it. The same thing applies to listed transactions.
But you see my question. My question is, if the taxpayers disclose on the required federal form, is there a identical state form that does the same thing?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. There is not a separate form.
Okay.
If they are attaching the form as part of their federal return, we would get a copy of that. But taxpayers don't always give us exactly what they filed with the IRS.
Right.
Yes.
So then that is that those reportable transactions at that point, had they all been reported for federal, but the form wasn't connected to the federal form that was attached, then that's a reportable form, or that's a reportable transaction which has not been reported to the state of Oregon.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The next thing is the listed transactions. If the taxpayer discloses the fact that they engaged in a listed transaction, then there's no penalty that applies to engaging in the transaction. And what happens is if the IRS looks at a transaction that may be reportable now, and then 2 years from now, they say, this is a really bad thing that you're doing, and they list it. The next return that is filed by the taxpayer needs to have a disclosure of the fact that 2 years ago, they engaged in the transaction. So, again, it's just disclosing the information. If they disclose it, there's no penalty associated with the fact that they engaged in the transaction. So now, after all of that occurs, if the IRS comes in and does an audit and says that listed transaction was abusive and involved tax evasion or tax avoidance and had no economic substance, then any additional tax can be charged penalty. But I just wanted to make sure that you you understood that the fact that they engage in a transaction doesn't necessarily mean there would be a penalty. It's if they don't disclose the transaction that penalties then apply.
So if there's no substance, therefore just for tax avoidance. Yes, Representative Byrd.
Okay, so we're back to that issue of look back. They did a reportable transaction in 2001. They reported it. 2 years later, the IRS has it as a listed, no longer reportable, and then discovered through whatever mechanism, magic that they do, that it was illegal, bad, and awful. Now you've got this taxpayer who reported it in 2001, and now it's illegal. But it wasn't in 2001. Is that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, not exactly. To my understanding, that is not exactly what works. Let's say that I engage in a transaction that is reportable under these regulations. It fits one of these six categories. I report that on the return, and I disclose it.
Mm-hmm.
2 years from now, the IRS says these transactions are now listed, and they put them on their website. They issue notices. They make all of that available. And now I'm on notice that the transaction I engaged in 2 years ago is now a listed transaction. With my next return, I should be reporting to the IRS the fact that I had a listed transaction. Now the IRS can come in and look at that transaction and say, okay, in the facts in this case, it was a good transaction. You had economic substance. You had a business reason. It was not abusive. Or they can look at it and say, you only did this to evade tax or avoid tax. You had no business purpose at all for that transaction. Assess tax and additional penalties for engaging in a listed transaction that was abusive.
Okay.
It's my understanding of how it works.
Okay. I'm beginning to get some.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions of Deborah? Thank you very much, Deborah. Deborah, I have a friend who will talk to you afterward. I got a question about a friend. I want to talk to you about that.
We've heard that. I've heard that story before.
You've heard that at school, huh?
Mr. Chair, I think I might know the same guy.
Okay. If the colleagues will come back and take a look at Senate Bill 480, there's obviously other sets of amendments. The A7, Representative Boquist, do you want to discuss those at this time?
I'll just throw out the A7 because based on your direction, Representative Berger and I looked at trying to define with the Department of Revenue what were these other potential under listed transactions that they might identify. And there were two specifically, two, a REIT and a RIC that were identified, and so those were identified from existing things in the state, and that's what the A7 does. And then the other thing that we talked about was, you know, the option on the appeal process and how that might work. And Deborah Buchanan was to look at my notes, was going to work with Paul and with Dexter downstairs to come up with, you know, solutions or definitions of those. And that's what the A7 is.
So
I kind of misspoke. I'm not sure Paul exactly saw all of them, but it has to do with Section 2 and Section 15 clarifications.
Okay. And that addresses Oregon's unique REIT and REC issues.
Affirmative.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, it does not, and I do note this, that it did not address the issue of the same type of topic under reportable transaction.
Okay.
So that would need to be addressed.
So if you'll continue to work with the department, and those are some concerns that we will, that need to be addressed and picked up in this whole process of compliance. Okay, Representative Berger.
And one last issue that I discussed briefly in that meeting is that I do want to get this thing through the body, a report back on the results of these kinds of efforts.
No, we're going to keep it secret.
So I'm looking as we craft it for ways to make it easily reportable.
Okay. Yep, that's an excellent suggestion. Colleagues, we've about worn the afternoon out. Thank you very much. No worry about any session at 3 o'clock, I guess. Go ahead and take the rest of the afternoon off. We'll close the work session and the public hearing and grab it for today.
Are we meeting tomorrow, Chairman Butler?